Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 17th, 2005. Today's session is called City of God, Where We Live and God's Creation. Choose then whom you will serve. Presented by Will Schroer, session number SCW-2005-03. Let's listen in.
How many of you have been to one of the other sessions in this sort of series? Great. Wonderful. My name is Will Schroer, and for those who have already heard my little self-introduction here, I apologize. When I do this sort of thing professionally, this is the time when I am supposed to tell about, you know, what consulting firm I'm associated with and all the things that I know and why you should pay attention to me. My contention here, and I don't get to do this in most places, is that the tools that one needs to discuss and understand these kinds of subjects are not academic or from a consulting firm, but exist in your own experience in your own life. And so I think that these are my qualifications to talk about these subjects, and you have similar, although not identical ones, presumably. The goal of the series, and especially of today, is to suggest to you ways that you can bring your own experience to participating in debates over urbanism, Christianity broadly, and then today, especially urbanism and economics. The big question that I've been putting up at the beginning of each day is Christianity pro or anti-place? And then a subset of that question is Christianity pro or anti-city? And as an introduction to that subject, I recommend this book, which is in the bookstore, called Sidewalks in the Kingdom, written by a pastor in Missoula, Montana, who has no training in urbanism or city planning or anything like that. And hello.
Hi.
Got interested in the subject, you know, from the direction of being the pastor of a church. And what he saw different parts of Missoula's urban design having an impact on his parishioners and on his ability to do his job, and he got interested in the subject from that direction. And I can't recommend this book highly enough. It's really a fantastic, I think, take on what Christianity should or should not have to say about city planning and urbanism generally. And I also find it very accessible. I would be much more strident than he is on some of these points, but that might also put some people off. And I think that as an entry into the subject, this is fantastic and will probably not put most people off. And he opens the book then with this question and tees up the question. I only want to spend a couple of minutes on this larger point before I get into today's subject, but it's so interesting. I just have to say it at the beginning of each day in case we have new people, which we do. In Genesis, and this also fits nicely in the week's theme that we're supposed to be talking about, God meets Moses in a place and says that this place is holy ground, take off your shoes. And the broader argument off of that is that God is very interested in places because that is where we are in places, and if God is going to work through us or with us or on us, God is going to do that in a place. And that those places, because they are the site of sacred activity, are then holy, and ergo, God is interested in places and is pro-place. More broadly, one can argue that God wants us to be happy and healthy, and we are happy and healthy only in places, more or less. The sort of rootlessness that characterizes a lot of modern life is not conducive to health or happiness. That's a much broader argument. The counter argument there is that back in Genesis, when God spoke to Moses, God was not so interested in the place. The place was kind of incidental. It's just where Moses happened to be. And when Moses moved on, God, in God's relationship with Moses, moved on as well. The place is really just a backdrop. God is interested in people, not in places. It turns out, large literature on how that strain of biblical interpretation that God is interested in people and not in places has led in part to where we are in sort of city planning and design today. that it would be sort of anti-Christian to care too much about the place or about the real stuff of, you know, the buildings that we're worrying about. We should only be worrying about the people, and everything else is just kind of background. So I recommend that sort of, this book as an introduction to that subject to you, then also this thought to you generally as we go through the week. Where we are in the week is, on Monday we looked at some slides about what we have built and are building, and asked which kinds of things make us feel better, and we've kind of decided that the things that we like are not the things that we're currently building. We talked about why that would be. Why would we build stuff that we don't like? Yesterday we talked about cities and relationships. The city is a machine for generating contact and relationships that was produced by a need for people to come in contact with each other when life was still mostly rural. And exists today, despite the internet and mail order and everything else, because people still need that contact. They still need to, they either need or like to be in physical contact with each other as part of a relationship. And given that fact, that how we design our cities can help or hinder those relationships, and we talked about that. So this gets us to today, in part on Monday, but also in part yesterday, we talked about, and certainly this is a subject which comes up whenever I talk about this subject. Okay, on Monday you claim that, you know, we're building a lot of, forgive me, crap, and, you know, we don't like it, but isn't it more efficient? Isn't it cheaper? Isn't it just the market at work? And so today what I'd like to talk about is the economics of city planning and design and road construction and all the things that hang off of that. But I want to do it in through the lens of economic storytelling. And this book is not in the library, but I also recommend it very, very highly. And I hold it up here because of the debt that I owe to it. This is, when I talk about economic stories, I'm talking out of material that I've learned in large part from this author, Donald McCloskey, called If You're So Smart, The Narrative of Economic Expertise. And if you want to page through it after the class, please feel free to do so. So we're going to talk today about economic stories. Let's start, before we get into economic stories, about just stories generally. Can I impose on somebody to give me a two-line story, the most basic story that you can think of that would constitute a story? And if you want to, so you're not quite at sea, you know, think about a children's story or a fairy tale or a...
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth.
Okay. What do people think? Is that a story?
I do.
You think that's a story? Okay. Another one? Someone else want to propose a story?
Once upon a time, a young man and a young woman met. They were separated by a conflict of some kind, and eventually they got together again and lived happily ever after.
Okay. This, to me, is closer to what I think of as a story, what I would bet that most people think of as a story. Let me propose, and many of you have seen my small daughter running around, probably yelling at the top of her lungs, but I've been reading a lot of children's stories recently, so let me talk about Jack and the Beanstalk as a story or not a story. Once upon a time, there was a poor boy, and one day all they had was a cow. One day the cow stopped giving milk, and then he was even poorer, which is how the story starts. Is that a story? Mm-hmm.
It's an intro.
It doesn't have a conclusion.
It's an intro, that's exactly right.
Story needs a conflict.
Very good. Or at the very minimum, it needs a dramatic development of some kind, which leads to something else. Once upon a time, there was a poor boy, his cow stopped giving milk. He traded the cow for a magic bean, then as a result, he became rich. And that leaves out how the magic bean let him become rich. But there was a beginning state, then a dramatic development, something happened, something came into the story, and then as a result, something else happened, and in the most satisfying story, I would argue, the beginning state is reversed. He started out poor, and then at the end, he was rich. And I will propose that is the, it's not to denigrate the creation story by any stretch, but it's only the beginning to me of the story. And the complete, albeit short story, beginning state, dramatic development, which leads to you can have dramatic developments that don't lead to anything, but then as a result, some finishing state, which may or may not be the inversion of the first book. Okay, an economic story is exactly that. Before I propose some, let's see if we can come up with some on our own. What would be an economics story in one or two lines that fulfills those? What, and start with, once upon a time, there was a...
developer.
Okay.
Whoa.
And what happened to him?
He bought a city block that was all run down.
Okay. And then as a result?
He tore down all the buildings and put up luxury condos.
And then he was?
Rich.
Okay. That's an economic story. Absolutely. Now, it may leave us with some questions, you know, but it's a story. For that matter, Jack and the Beanstalk can be construed as an economics story. Mm-hmm. Started out poor, dramatic development, became rich. Okay. I would propose that many of the economic stories that we are told today by policymakers, politicians, other people are fundamentally Jack and the Beanstalk stories. These people started out poor, then this thing happened, which I had something to do with, and now they're rich, right? And a lot of times, you know, it's a little bit hard to tell where the, you know, dramatic development really makes sense any more than a magic bean makes sense. But those are economic stories. In urban development, there are, and planning, there are very short stories, no longer than those stories, that I want us to think about today. Normally they are not told as stories. And the number one thing that I would like you to take away today, if you care to take anything away, is a desire and ability to turn a statement into a story. Because all economic statements are stories. They're not usually, sometimes they are explicitly told as stories. Russia was poor and then they became capitalist and now they're rich. There's a story, and that is a story that is told all the time in the press in not much more detail than that. Now, it turns out to be an untrue story. Russia is not richer now than it was, but it's a story that gets told anyway. But let's leave Russia out of it for the moment and talk about, since we are here to talk about cities and economics, let's translate some of these statements into stories. I've done the first one to get us going. You hear all the time, well, you know, it's sprawl, okay, maybe we're not wild about it, but it's the result of the market at work. Now, that's a statement, or it's an argument. It's not, in that form, a story. One of the stories that I think that statement applies is, once upon a time, there was a regular city with a regular downtown, true enough, and then the market started to work, and as a result, the town sprawled and the downtown died. That's one story that one can create out of that statement. Now, do you think that that's a fair translation of story, of statement into story?
Are you saying we have to buy those and we can't argue? Like,
No. The whole point is
sprawl as a result of market working. I think that's a lie.
Okay.
I don't think that's true.
And let's start with the story, then. Let's critique not the statement, but the story as a way of figuring out why it would be a lie. Because a lot of people believe this. Now, which part of the story do you think that they are wrong about?
Well, with regard to number one, if certain people that had a responsibility had carried out their responsibility thoughtfully and carefully and had not been off playing, then a certain amount of, without even thinking in terms of market terms, a certain amount of increase in the population and the size of the town or city could be accommodated and still have regard for people who have less means, and also make place for people that have more means, and keep a balance and responsibility, have a reasonable tax system, da 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 da. In other words, you could have a very happy ending, and some of us know one or two cities like that, and of course we know a million of them that aren't.
Yes. Now, those cities embody different stories.
Yeah, they end up with a different story than that.
Can you embody one of those stories in a short story? once upon a time there was a city that, you know, wasn't doing so well, and then something happened, and then as a result it was the kind of city that we like. What's the story that...
Yeah, in this imaginary city, some of the people who realized that they were poor, and that some of their fellows were becoming homeless, decided that they needed to have a different approach than what they had learned all of their life. So they formed a cooperative. They decided they would cooperatively find sources for food, for rentals, for places to live, for clothing. They would be able to help each other out in all these different ways. If I could have gone further back, I would have gone to the grain system, which worked really well developed in the area I just came from, that I normally lived in.
Okay, I think that's a good story. That's a story about a cooperative approach. And you can actually tell it relatively quickly. You know, it doesn't include all the good details, but it's...
I don't have any practice doing this, by the way.
No, it's fine, it's great. This is what we're here for, is to... we're trying to tell a story about a market system. I mean, I think a cooperative system is a form of a market system. Don't get me wrong. But I want to try and focus on a critique of this particular story, since it's one that we hear so often. Hey, it's just the market at work. And I think that I'll just tell you, I find that story to be not compelling, but it takes an effort to figure out which step of the story is the part where it falls apart, right? If you think about storytelling, economic storytelling, or any other kind, as being sort of, think about it in a courtroom, the prosecution gets up and says, I'm going to tell you a story about how this crime happened, right? This happened, and then this, and he builds kind of a case. In the courtroom, we call it a case. Out here, we'll just call it a story, but it's still a story either place, right? Folks that think that the development patterns that we're seeing, which we'll just call sprawl for shorthand, are the result of the market telling this story. You know, people had, once upon a time, there was this regular city, and it had downtowns and everything. And then, as a result of the market working, and people's preferences for more land and more space, and they liked to drive, and they wanted to shop in big box stores, then as a result, we had sprawl. That's the slightly longer version of this story that I've put up here, but that's the story that they're telling, right? Now, you're the opposing attorney, and you get up and you say, you know, this guy's told you this story, and he makes it sound it's all fine, you know, it's just the market at work. It's your job to poke holes in that story. What holes are you going to poke in his story?
First of all, sprawl, when it occurs, I mean, you need to build the infrastructure that the city, county, or state has to provide, and then the city, county, or state has to maintain all this infrastructure, and so it gets more and more expensive, especially if you're a northern city, whereas generally northern cities are smaller and compact because they have to move snow around and they have to do a lot more work just to keep the roads open than they would, like, for LA, where they really don't have to worry about that so much.
And the state is building all this infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Is the market building it?
No.
Ah! Ladies and gentlemen, our first hole in the story. The market is not working to build that infrastructure. The state is working to build that infrastructure, okay? Now, maybe the market follows it, I don't know. But we have a pure story here. The prosecution has told you a pure story that doesn't involve the state, it's only the market. And now the defense comes and says, oh, wait a minute, I think you forgot part of the story here. It's not the market, we have an accomplice. And which we call the state. And by the state, I don't mean just the state of Minnesota, but the feds and, you know, the government as a whole. And so it's not just the market at work, there's a big chunk of government involved to build the roads that we are partially sprawl. That's what I'm looking for in terms of poking a hole in this story. Can we poke any other holes in this story?
Well, it just suggests this entire passivity on the part of this downtown that they could do nothing to stop from dying, and that nobody was planning or thinking about that. So it doesn't seem to take into count the various factions that should be at work.
Okay, that's good. So there are other folks involved in this story, some of whom are trying to stem the tide of Sprawl and maybe not succeeding.
Or are they, are the planners planning for the Sprawl? Or?
Planners are planning for, and how would a planner plan for Sprawl?
By building roads.
Okay, what else might they do?
By providing economic incentives for suburbia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in the form of?
Tax breaks, yeah.
Very good. Okay.
I have to beg to differ with you. In my experience, no planner in their right mind would do that, but they operate within an intense political environment. And so that's what really makes the decisions.
Okay.
They claim they'll do that, but they somehow never get around to the actual steps of doing it.
So for planners providing economic incentives, let's substitute politicians providing tax breaks and economic incentives. Fair enough.
And when they say big roads are more efficient, that's assuming you need a road instead of some other mass transit or light rail or heavy rail
Let's stick just with the first story.
Oops, sorry.
Then okay. We'll protect the second and third ones. But let's stick just with the first one, that the market is at work here.
Okay.
Those are two good ones, and those are great. And you see where I'm trying to head here. We're being told a pure story. And I'm not against pure or simple stories. Many stories are pure and simple, but they can leave out, and I would argue that this is not even a result of leaving out detail, that this straight story fundamentally misrepresents. It's not an effort to strip down and leave out detail. It's an effort to leave out fundamental forces that are actually part and parcel of the story. Yes?
Well, the market is working, but it's because there are usually incentives for the suburban stores that don't exist for downtown. And so naturally that's where the money goes, where they get something back.
Okay. Thank you. And I will wrap on this particular story by suggesting one other implication here, that when people say, hey, it's the result of the market working, the implication is it's a free market at work. And we believe in free markets in this country, and so whatever the market produces, that must be the right thing, right? And the implication is always that the market is free to work, and a tax break or subsidy or leading the market by putting roads and saying, don't you want to come out here, is not a free market at work.
Now, I wonder whether it isn't deeper than that. Isn't it true that in a way, way back in the Wealth of Nations, the proposal of market working that was given was that those who were benefiting would take care of those who needed their, in other words, they would become shepherds rather than hogs. And what actually happens in the market that we're around is that those who are driving the market are getting everything at the expense of everybody they can possibly squeeze thing out of. And like the woman said back there, it's almost a hopeless case.
I'm going to tell another story.
Please, this is what we're about here, stories.
You'll recognize the name of this story.
Okay.
There's a village, and they have a village green, and everybody who lives in the village has a goat, and they each graze their goat on the village green, and they all take care of the green together. And then one guy decides to buy 100 goats and graze his goats on the village green, and pretty soon the grass is all gone. But he doesn't care, because the village is going to repair the damage to the green. It's not a cost out of his pocket. So it's the tragedy of the commons. What happens when you can have an impact on the society, but the cost doesn't actually come back to you? Somebody else absorbs it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good economic story. And that's part of this as well. In a well-functioning market, people bear the costs of their actions. And in Sprawl, a lot of times they don't. For any number of reasons. One would be that someone else has paid the cost of the road, and they're just going to benefit from it. They're not paying for the cost of providing the access to their land. On the flip side, they're not maybe paying for the pollution that they're causing. Now, probably the people downtown aren't paying for the pollution that they're causing either. If you produce more pollution on the edge of the city than you do downtown, then the folks on the edge have an economic advantage, because they can produce more pollution for free. Well, we're doing very well on critiquing this very little story, and I guess one conclusion that one might draw from that is that one should be suspicious of short little stories because they leave a lot of detail out. The folks that were here on Monday, we went through, this comes right back to what we were talking about on Monday, about why we build what we build. And one of the reasons that we build things that we don't like is that, in fact, the market in urban economics is in no way free. I'm not going to show Monday's slides all over again, but basically the three things that I suggest to you, three categories of unfreeness in the urban market is, as you suggested, the roads. The state pays a tremendous amount of money to not only build mostly roads, but only roads of a certain kind. If you want to build a small road, a very pedestrian-friendly road, if you want to build a multimodal road with a transit, you know, in the median, that's very, very difficult to do. If you just want to build a big divided lane freeway, that's very easy to do. The state will pay for that, certainly no questions asked. That's not a free market in transportation, and none of the land happens without transportation access to it. Land only has value if you can get to it, right? And so the market is horribly skewed by this unfree market in transportation. So that's the first thing. The second thing is zoning. And this is what I was trying to get you to say, but you did fine anyway, with the tax breaks. The market in land is not free because it is zoned. And you are not able, as a developer, to put anything that you want on your land. The planners tell you what you may or may not put there according to the zoning designation. We can spend, if people want, time talking about the history of zoning and why that is the case, but for the purposes of critiquing the story, I will suggest to you the market of land is not free. People cannot reach agreements with each other to buy or sell and then build land according to what they would like to do without involving the state. The state sets very tight limits about what you can do. It's not a free market. And then third, is that a tremendous amount of parking requirements go with any development decision, and that horribly skews the market. When you are required to build a lot of parking with whatever it is that you're building, whether it's residences or offices, that skews your decision about how and where to build those buildings. And if you must build a lot of parking, and parking takes land, and land is cheaper on the edge, then you will move to the edge to comply with that requirement to build the parking because it's cheaper to do so.
Can I ask a question? Sure. How does this fit in? Where I am from, what I'm thinking about is in Pierce County, in this state, outside of Tacoma, but it includes Tacoma. And what we have, I guess if we're gonna be really honest, is we have a Master Builders Association, which is a club of mostly men who control the politics, they control the zoning, they control the planning, they control the developing, and their opinions are considered true and righteous, even when they border on idiocy. And the citizens that try to resist things, such as our wonderful friend Bill and Roxy Giddings, are just laughed at. Hard to consider at all.
Well, I think that's an example of some of the things I'm trying to talk about here. I think that most people, and I think that's part of the situation that you describe, take it largely at face value and sort of uncritically accept some of these statements.
Yeah, the newspaper does, I'll tell you.
And then the newspaper, right, exactly. And so what I'm hoping to do here is to help us critique those statements a little bit. And then how do you take that into that political process? You know, that's a tough question. It can be successfully challenged. It takes a lot of time, effort, and money, no surprise. I think that the way in, one of the ways in, is to start understanding and then helping other people understand these claims and what is a little bit wrong with them.
Another thing that's going on in that very same area is the expression is starve the beast, which I'm sure you heard. And basically we have almost a one-man show who has convinced more than half the population that having to pay taxes is always bad, has no benefit whatsoever. and that has to be resisted at all costs. What, not even telling him why, just telling him that that's what the facts are.
Yeah.
And of course.
And they use very simple. He uses very. They use some very simple stories.
Sure. Sure. Yep. Yes.
I want to tie back to what you started with on Monday about why do we build stuff that we don't like. It's the Home Builders Association in Spokane that similarly says we have to be able to build this because this is what the market demands. This is what people want. Well, it's counterintuitive to me. I have yet to understand why the people ask for one thing and the builders argue that they need to be able to build something else. Maybe it's just because that's what they're used to doing and that's what they can do cost effectively. But the market does seem to be somewhere else other than where they're building, and they're not really responsive to
Well, there's a couple of things going on here, I think. One is that any industry, and I suggest that the home builders are no different than any other industry, changes reluctantly and slowly. They know how to make money doing what they're doing. And doing something differently is a risk.
And threat.
And the threat, exactly, to their. And to get into a little bit more detail, the kinds of things that I think work in urban development take a little bit more, they take slightly larger companies to pull off. Mixed-use development, where there's apartments over retail, for example, is a fairly complex kind of thing to do. Building a single-family house is not a complex thing to do. Mom-and-pop companies can do it. Most builders are mom-and-pop companies. Most builders are going to find it difficult to do a mixed-use development with apartments over retail. Now, that was the norm for a long time. It's not that complicated to do. You know, we haven't gotten dumber over time. If we used to be able to do it, surely we can do it again. We can. But the folks that are running the industry now, that's not what they do, and they feel threatened by the suggestion that they should be doing something else. So that's one thing. And you know, I think that's a human, and don't get me wrong, I'm no finer of these people than you are, but I think it's a human reaction on their part, and I wouldn't probably demonize them for it. The second thing that happens is that we're in a sort of a catch-22 or a vicious circle or whatever the right analogy is. All that's provided right now are these sort of single-family, you know, subdivisions. People have to buy something. They buy those. The builders, again, quite reasonably say, well, we sold out all our single-family homes. That must be what people want. Now, I say, you know, there's no free market here. There was no choice. There's no chance for the market to work and for people to express their preference for something else. And I will tell you, we talked about this again on Monday, that sounds like a broken record, but when choice is provided, when people have the choice of moving into smaller homes, mixed-use homes, moving into apartments over, you know, downtown, et cetera, they buy it like crazy, and the prices go through the roof. At which point one might say, well, that's an interesting story, but if that's true, why aren't the builders, if they can really charge so much more for this product, you know, why don't they go into, why don't they demand the right to build that? Why don't they march on City Hall and say, for God's sake, zone us some mixed-use development so we can make piles of money? And I come back to the first story, which is they don't know how to do that yet, okay?
They what?
They don't know how to do it yet, right? They only know how to build one kind. And so they are going to exercise every piece of power and economic, you know, power that they have in order to keep that kind of that business model going. I gave this exact same talk this morning, which is a nice thing because then you can talk about it over lunch and hopefully do it better the second time around. I have no idea if I can do it the second time. But somebody said to me, said, you know, this reminds me of the beer industry, at which my ears immediately perked up because I was very interested in the beer industry. He said, you know, in the 70s, we thought beer was done for because it was just coming down to, you know, there were all these regional breweries and they were all going out of business or being bought up. And it was just, we were just sure that it was going to end up being Bud and Miller. And that was going to be our big choice, you know. And everyone said, oh, trust the market at work, you know. And there were a number of people that said, you know, this is crap and we're going to start our own microbrewery. And that kind of took off. And now you, I think, have a much healthier market in beer in which there are a lot of microbrews. The big beer has, in some cases, started their own faux microbrew brands. And I'll be happy to tell you what those are so you can't buy them, so you can stop buying them. But
they also bought out one of the first microbrews.
Yes, they did. That's right. But, you know, it's a much healthier, and so it's not all as well in beer land, but it's much better than it was. And the difficulty is, you know, if you don't like, the difference between beer and Holmes, unfortunately, is that if you don't like Bud and Miller, you can stop buying Bud and Miller. Or you can go out and start your own microbrewer and you can drink wine, and eventually they get the message, right?
Or homebrew.
Sorry?
Or homebrew.
Or homebrew, yes. Exactly, that's exactly right. What is the story that we're telling in the housing market? That option isn't open to you because roads, zoning, you know, instead of parking, et cetera, it's very difficult to break out of this vicious circle where only subdivisions, single family, you know, single use subdivisions get built. They sell out because people have to live someplace. People can legitimately argue, well, they sold out, the market must want them. It's very difficult to get into that, and the single person, you know, can't just quit, you know, buying the house. Or it's much more difficult to just quit buying into that, yes.
Another thing is they have a stranglehold on the codes, and there may be something that's way more viable economically that they won't make as much profit on, and therefore it won't. They won't allow it in the code.
The good news is that this is changing. There is a way to stop this vicious circle, interrupt it, and move on to other things. And that's the subject of our entire hour on Friday. So I encourage you to come hear about those on Friday. But I think this is a fantastic discussion because these are exactly the stories that get told. The developer comes out and says, the market wants it, and I'm meeting the demands of the market, and that is a story which you have rightfully criticized as being unsatisfying somehow. And you maybe didn't have all the economics tools to say, well, there's not a free market, you know, et cetera, but you knew immediately there was an unsatisfying story. And that is exactly the kind of critical attitude that you need to take to these stories. Shall we move off of the market as a working story and critique a couple of the others?
Sure.
Okay. The next part of the one-line story is, or the statement that I want us to translate into story is, big roads are more efficient. Would somebody like to put that in story form so that we can critique it from the perspective of the story? Yes.
Look at all the congestion there. If we just build a bigger road, you know, maybe more limited access, put three more lanes in each direction, we'd have no more traffic jam.
Okay.
And then
good.
A year later, we're back to where we started.
Right. Once upon a time, there was a narrow road and it was congested, and then we widened it and traffic flowed more freely. That's the story. And it's a compelling story to most people. Is it compelling to you? Because?
You've seen it not work.
You've seen it not work. You've seen the story not turn out to be true in the way that people tell it to be true.
You've even seen a road be narrowed.
I'm sorry?
You've seen a road be narrowed from four lanes to two and work more efficiently.
And it works more efficiently, yes.
Back to Pierce County, a while back, a part of the county did not want to be in the big city, Tacoma. They wanted to be their own city, Ferncrest and University Place. And when they incorporated, everybody laughed that they were going to be a total financial disaster and failed in no time at all. And what they did is they decided they would slow everything down, control the traffic, and they put in traffic circles, they put in some barriers, they did some of the things he said, they narrowed the road. And yeah, there was a lot of talk about how it was bad, but boy, did the people love it.
They loved it.
Because, oh, and they even put in cameras on the stoplights so the people who ran red lights would get a ticket in the mail. It's been really controversial. But as a result of that, that now is highly developed. I mean, a desirable place for people to be. It's more livable.
Yes, it works. And so that one can tell a powerful story about it. Now I have to tell you, this story is a little bit more difficult to critique, just because the story that, I'll just say they, although I'm not wild about the sort of us in that, but just to be easy about it, the story that road people will tell is so immediately on its face compelling to people that it's a little bit more difficult to critique. And one of the points of entry for critique, I think, is that they are drawing an analogy between people and anything else that one might put through a facility. In the engineer's view, a road is a facility like a pipeline, and the bigger it is, the more stuff you can put through it, which, again, on its face is not a ridiculous story. But think about that. What's wrong with that analogy? Are people water? Are people... No. Because water doesn't think and behave and act. It's inanimate, and people do. And so the design of the pipeline, or in this case the road, will affect how people respond to it. And as the gentleman suggests, empirically, when you change the design, counterintuitively, in fact, sometimes when you make the pipe smaller, you can put more water through it, which, an idea which makes an engineer crazy. But empirically, it's true. And here, if people would like, I can give, you know, a 5-minute sort of view into why that would be the case, if you would like. This gets away a little bit from storytelling, but I think it's part of it. And people are generally curious about it, so maybe, if you don't mind. Oh wait, I know what I'm doing here, I'm sorry. I had this all teed up, and now I'm doing it wrong. Here it is. Okay, this was from yesterday when I talked about relationships in the city, that is the perfect illustration for this. The argument that the big road is more efficient is part of a larger story. And this is the larger story, which when they tell the short story, this is some of the detail that gets left out. This is the big road that they're building, and that's the more efficient road. But that is fed by, are these big roads connected to each individual little block?
No.
Very, very rarely, almost never, right?
In fact, they usually close those when they build big roads.
That's exactly right. And so, either because they've closed the connection once they've widened this road, or because they built it this way to begin with, what you have instead of this more traditional, what we call a grid system, is you have what's called a hierarchical street network. So the local road, the collector road, and the arteria, in the technical jargon, which you don't have to remember, but if you care to, it's sort of interesting. Anyway, everyone likes the idea of having local roads that don't have a lot of traffic on them. Everyone likes the It sort of makes sense on its face that you would then collect the traffic from the local roads, and then you would have the through traffic that you don't really want on your neighborhood roads anyway. You would have that out here, and you would, again, in fine engineer fashion. I should have asked, is anyone in the room an engineer? I don't mean to beat up.
They just left.
But you left. Perfect. Alienating my audience already. The story on its face is not, you know, ridiculous, right? And we're all used to the idea of different kinds of facilities serving different purposes. You just have to spin the story out to its conclusion. What happens here? Every morning, all these people need to go to school, to work, to whatever. So they all, you know, get in their cars and come down to the collector, and then they all end up right here to get onto the arterial. What happens?
Traffic jam.
Massive traffic jam. So they're like, oh, we didn't build the interchange big enough. And so they widen the interchange. Exactly. What happens in the same? What happens at 8 a.m. here? Everyone goes to work. If there's now, it may be that everyone wants this is. Let's say the downtown is right here, and so this is the fast way downtown. Let's say hypothetically. So, I mean, the first idea is that everyone will take. You know, they'll spread the traffic out over each of the individual streets. But say that that's not even the case, okay? In fact, everyone wants to come out this way. But as soon as there's, you know, a backup here, then people say, St. Clair always jams up. Let's take Jefferson. Jefferson's jammed up. Let's take, you know, Osceola. And there's choice, okay? And just to try and redeem myself with the engineer to the left, unfortunately, you know, this is an equally valid, and if anything, older and more valid tradition in engineering, that you provide redundancy and choice in your system, so that if one part of it gets jammed up, the whole thing doesn't collapse. Okay, and so it's not that I'm trying to throw out engineering; it's that I'm trying to bring it back in some ways to its truer roots. The other reason that the bigger road doesn't work is not more efficient. Is who wants to take a crack at another reason why it doesn't work as well?
Hard to get from A to B in that system.
Yes, so what do you do?
It doesn't go where you want to go.
So what happens as a result?
Well, you have to go on this big roundabout way.
So two things happen. The first is that, let's say, you want to go from here to here, okay? Now, two things happen. The first is, even though this is, let's say this is one distance apart, 1 mile, maybe even a cul-de-sac, not a mile apart, but anyway, let's say it's one. And then, you know, you want to go 1 mile as the crow flies. In order to do that, you have to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And to go 9 over here, you can just go 9. Or you can go, if it's up here, you go, you know, but it's much more direct, right? Even though it's longer, it's more direct. So to make the same trip, let's just say you want to go, let's just say you want to visit your next door neighbor here, quote unquote next door, quote unquote next door, right? To go 1 here, you go 1. And to go here, you go 9. You've put 9 times as much traffic on the system. You got to build 9 times as much road. You're not going to build 9 times as much road. Maybe you're going to build 4 or 5 times as much, but you know, you're not going to build an order of magnitude more roads, right? So that's the first thing. To make the same trip, to have the same number of automobile trips, you got to build a lot more road. And even though we do build a lot more road, we don't build that much more road. And the second thing is, this produces a lot more car trips. Not only does it produce longer ones, it produces more. Because you can't walk this. 99% of the time, you cannot walk between these two cul-de-sacs, right? There's fences or there's, you know, whatever there is. Let's say this isn't a next door neighbor, but this is where the milk is. Actually, the milk is out here. But, you know, and maybe you can walk to the milk, but probably you can't. But let's stick with our original example. You want to go visit your neighbor. The kid, you know, your kid is in class with this kid and they want to do homework together. He can't walk that way, so mom has to drive him. Over here, he can walk. Over here, he has to drive or be driven. And so this system produces less traffic, fewer car trips, and this produces more. They're longer, and they all end up, even if there were more and longer, there's no way to distribute them and allow people to have choice. They all have to go through here. They're always going to get jammed up. So that's why bigger roads are not more efficient. Now, that's a hard story to collapse into a single story, right? The bigger road story is our more efficient is an easy story to tell, and it sounds compelling to people. And I'm going to suggest one last thing here, and then let's move on to the last story. I get very enthusiastic about these things, as you can tell. My friends sometimes caution me. They said, you know, well, you run the risk, or maybe the risk, oftentimes you come across as, you know, well, the engineers must be morons. Or people must be stupid for believing the engineers, right? And if your theory is that people are dumb, that's a bad theory. Okay? That's not a sustainable theory. And so what are you really doing? And this is where you have to acknowledge some point of truth in the story that people are believing. Now, why are, Nancy, yes?
Well, go ahead. I have a question.
Okay, fine. I'll finish up this point. Now,
want your grid to fill up there when I have.
Okay, good. Now, people buy the bigger roads or more efficient story in part, not just because it sounds good, but why else? In their experience, much of the time it's true. Much of the time this is faster, right? So it doesn't sound like a lie. And it's not meant to be a lie. Okay, I'm using lie as a shorthand, as a thing that is an untrue statement. There's a pejorative interpretation of lie, which is that they want you to believe something which isn't true. But let's just stick to the objective evaluation that it's not true. But much of the time it is true, right? Now, I used to live in, and I still live, I'm fortunate enough to live in a neighborhood like this. Not only do you rarely see the pure example of this, but you don't even want always the pure example of this. You want some bigger roads that you can get on. You don't want all the traffic going through the neighborhood. When I go to the airport, I take 62. People who live in Minneapolis know what I mean, right? This is a 62. It's better for everybody. It's faster for me. It keeps me off of in front of people's houses. I'm always late to the airport. They don't want me driving past their front porch at 50 miles an hour. And so, you know, the answer is not that we only do this thing and anyone who suggests this is a moron. The suggestion is that you critique claims that the one, and you should critique my claim that this is always better, right? But we should critique the story that the big road is always better because it's not the full story and the implication is empirically not true. This does not work better. It just doesn't. But people believe the short story because sometimes this does work better. And so in their experience, they have a hard time finding the way in to critique the short story. Does that make sense? Hey, Nancy.
My question is that what happens to people when they live on a different grid? We had a, and here's my example. We had a, when you sort of, when the two grids kind of intersect with each other. the neighborhood we live in, Seattle, is near the University of Washington, near Husky Stadium. And on Saturdays in the fall, when there are football games at Husky Stadium, it's also a very congested traffic area with terrible freeway, it's awful. But they have this system. It's beautiful. It works beautifully. Our neighborhood is really only two ways out of it, but we know that between about 4:45 and 5:15 on a Saturday afternoon in a Husky game, we can't go out the front way. We have to go out the back way. And it's a grid kind of like that inside the neighborhood and stuff. And it works beautifully. No, there's never any congestion. Everybody knows the routine. You know, it just goes beautifully. About 4 years ago, the professional football team in Seattle, Seahawks, they imploded the kingdom, and they were going to build a new stadium, which could take 2 years. So they had their Sunday games in Husky Stadium. And this was a great neighborhood. They did a lot of statistics. One thing they found is 85% of the people that go to Seahawks games live in the suburbs. Every single Sunday there was a Seahawks game, even though they ran the same thing, gave everybody the plans, they gave people free bus tickets to play, you know, park places and go things like that. It was total and complete gridlock in the entire, in about an entire, about a 2 mile square area in northeast Seattle for about an hour and a half after each game. And what, looking at your thing, what I figured out about that is that everybody who lives on the grid on the left thinks that every time they see a straight road, they can go there. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, right.
And so all the neighborhood streets got clogged with traffic. Even though they're being directed down other streets.
Yes.
It never got fixed after 2 years. Same people.
Right.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, I think what you're saying, or maybe this is an extrapolation of mine off of what you're saying, is people here, because they can't walk between A and B, decide that the only way to go anywhere is by car.
Right.
And here people apply a little more, I'm going to be pejorative again, thoughtfulness to their transportation decision making, and they kind of think about, well, what happens if I do X, what happens if I do Y? These people decide that there's no choice to be made, except maybe to not, you know, don't go get the milk at 8 in the morning because everyone's on the way to work, too, right?
But I think they all thought a straight road would get them somewhere that was efficient for them.
Yes, right. That's not true. How are we doing on critiquing big roads are more efficient?
Also, with there have been studies that, okay, we're going to widen this road, we're going to make four lanes. So they make four lanes, but the road takes so long to build, but by the time they built it, the developers figure, okay, well, we can throw up developments all along this big road before, you know, because it's going to be there, and then it opens up and it's no better or even worse than it was before.
Absolutely. the real extreme of that study, there was a study recently that the argument for widenings is sometimes it's to serve new people, of course. Sometimes it's just to serve the same people more quickly. And the most fascinating study that I saw was that those people, in many cases, will never make back the time they lost during the construction delay. Forget the new people, right? But the existing users are so inconvenienced by the construction, they will never make that time back. Which is, anyway. Anyway, let's wrap up the big roads. I suggest to you that not only is this story suspect, but statistically, I can smother you with statistics that these don't work very well. My goal being here at Holden was just personally, selfishly, I do that kind of numbers work all the time, and I just didn't want to do it on my vacation. And I wanted to do something more interesting, like talk about storytelling and economics. So I hope that I've been vaguely useful. Now, I don't do it all the time, and so I'm not confident that I'm so good at it as I am with the statistics. But it's also my experience that people don't come to Holden, they hear a lot of statistics, and you forget them on the boat on the way out. So, you know, if you want to hear the numbers, I'm happy to give them to you. But what I suggest to you is that what you take away and what hopefully lasts past the boat ride is a skepticism toward these kind of stories and a desire to take them apart and examine their constituents a little bit. Let me throw up the last story and we can spend the last 5 minutes on that if you want.
Can I tell us a quick Wide Road economic story while you're changing?
Please, please.
In Spokane, we had our usual commercial strip, five lanes with your big stores and chain stores on either side. But it functioned. I mean, that was the place where everybody knew to go for that stuff. Then the traffic engineers decided that it wasn't moving traffic fast enough, so they converted that whole five, six lane area into one way and then built another parallel five or six lane road behind it to go the other way, and all the businesses died because people are now whizzing past at 50 miles an hour. They can't get to one side or the other or where the business was. They can't, they're used to approaching it on the right and now it's on the left and they can't get over and turn. And so the businesses saw that the wider roads didn't work for them because they didn't have access to their shoppers that they had had before. All the shoppers are whizzing by on the back road going in the other direction.
Were they able to solve that, or?
It's still the way it is. The businesses are all closing down. I don't know what's going to happen.
Before they might have been able to park at one business, walk across the street to do something else.
Well, maybe. I mean, six lanes of traffic, you don't want to walk across the street. But I mean, they were two directions of traffic, and it was more dynamic.
Well, the last sort of piece of the, well, it's not last piece of the puzzle in suburbia, but certainly a dominant one, is the big box store. The same story is told about big boxes as are told about big roads, that they're efficient and therefore good. Someone want to put that in story form? Once upon a time, there were small mom and pop stores, and then
Walmart
came, and as a result,
everybody else.
No, we're telling the story now from the perspective of the pro sort of sprawl, and then as a result, people saved a lot of money. People had access to cheaper stuff. Now, when Pam introduced herself as my TA back in the introductory part of this, and when I was putting this together, our hope was that we would have a more interesting sort of session here where first we talk about, is it more efficient, and then even if it is more efficient, is that what Christianity is about? Is that what we are, as Christians, should we choose is cheaper better in the Christian context? Now, it's now 4:45 and we have no time, and Pam hasn't really been a part of this, which is entirely my fault. But so I suggest that that question to you as one to take away, because we're not going to be able to treat it here today. But strictly on the technical economics of it, certainly they are cheaper at the point of sale. But is that the only calculation, even the only economic calculation? Leave out the quality of life, leave out all the stuff that it's difficult to put a number on. Is that the only economic calculation that we want to take into account?
Well, there's the money that the big stores make, but nobody counts in the loss that all the other stores, severe economic loss that has happened to them. Start putting the two together.
Exactly.
It's not such a great deal anymore.
That's exactly right.
What about where do the big stores send the money that they make?
Where do they send the money?
Yeah.
And where do they get the goods?
Where do they get the goods?
And the space they use to create the store, goods? The parking, and
How well they pay their employees and whether they have benefits.
And also, if you count time as money.
So glad that somebody said this. Thank you.
The other day I needed vacuum bags, just vacuum bags. And I could go to Walmart, but I don't. So I went to A to W, vacuum, whatever. Just this tiny little hole in the wall. I parked, it was on a strip, but it's a small, but I parked, it's not a strip. It's a strip for Helena. Population 25,000. But anyway, it's not downtown, but it's sort of on the side road. Anyway, but I did park in front. 5 feet from the door. I walked in. The man said, "Oh, hello. How can I help you?" I said, "I need this kind of vacuum bag." He pulled it from the wall. I paid for it. I was back home in 7 minutes, which would be impossible if I'd done it.
Absolutely. And it always kills me that people who know that, I mean, one of the things I promised on my little thing on the wall was we'll have some economist jokes.
Yeah.
We haven't had any yet, and Linnea has done it for me. The joke is that the economist is the person that knows the price of everything but the value of nothing. I think we've become a nation of those kinds of economists. We know the price of everything at Walmart, but we don't know the value of our own time. And what it boils down to, honestly, here I kind of leave my technical professional background and I start to rant, but what are we doing when we drive to the Walmart to take advantage of the lower price? We're working for Walmart, right? They didn't want to take the trouble to, you know, what did this guy do? He has taken the trouble to have a specialized, you know, vacuum bag department. He knows where everything is. He's taken the trouble to make it easy for you. Walmart has not taken the trouble to make it easy for you, right? Because trouble is money and they're not going to take it. You are going to take the trouble. You are going to drive out of town. You are going to find the vacuum bag located in the aisle, God knows where, right? You are going to walk through the giant parking lot. You are going to invest all this time to save, you know what? Now, it's not my place to suggest that, you know, I know the value of people's time better than they do. Only they can make that decision. But I do think it's sort of odd that, you know, people are like, I don't have any time. And then they end up, you know, driving that long. Well, you know, why don't you shop at the little store that's near your house? It's faster, but anyway.
And they spend a lot more money when they go to the big store, too.
Well, I was going
to
say, and the big store doesn't want you to get it in there officially.
No, they don't.
They want you to stop at aisle 7 and aisle 8 and aisle 9 and get all the other
instead of $5
stuff
spend
that you probably don't really need, but you happen to see while you're on your way to trying to find the vacuum bags.
And then there's the matter of isolationist and connectivity, and the people don't know you, and
sure.
they don't remember from one time to
sure.
another, and customer service, and
the clerk doesn't know what a vacuum bag is.
The best take on the connectivity and the relationship and all that other, I think, was my favorite take on it, anyways, from Garrison Keillor in like Wobegon days, and he talks about small towns as being run on a sort of semi-socialist system. And you know, you exercise mutual sort of responsibility and reciprocity with each other. You don't go to the mall in St. Cloud to get Calvin Klein eyewear, even though it looks better on you, because Calvin Klein is not going to teach your kid the catechism, right? And you know, it's hard to improve on that take. But I come back to my friend's admonition to not develop a theory of people are morons, because that's not a sustainable theory. You know, people are going to Walmart. They think that they're better off as a result. I wonder why they think that sometimes, but clearly they do. And they're telling themselves a story, which is in part an economic story. And why don't we wrap with my repeated then admonition to just think about what that story might be. And if you're talking with them about it, or to yourself, because I bet that there are Walmart shoppers in the room, and it would heap shame on you by asking you to out yourself. But you know, think about the story that you're telling yourself when you do that, and whether it you know holds up to scrutiny. With that, I will wrap my presentation, but we can hang, and I don't have anywhere to go, and I don't think there's anything after me. So thank you very much.
Well, there's another theory that people that work at Walmart generally aren't paid very well, and so they end up having to buy everything at Walmart. That's because that's the only place they can afford to buy the things they need, so it creates kind of this vicious circle.
It's the tragedy of the common story all over again, because locally owned businesses typically put 3 times more back into your local economy. So you're shooting yourself in the foot. You're cutting off your nose to spite your face, but getting something cheap here and losing out all the way around.
But if you're really poor, that may be your better option.
No, I agree, yeah. Absolutely. And I think, if I may, it's not a pure case of the tragedy of the commons, but it's a generalized case of it, where the individual's interest is not the community's interest. Yeah. And the challenge of economics in the community is to help make the individual's and the community's interest the same. That is the challenge of economics in the community. When we did this morning, we had some sort of piling onto the market and onto economics and economics generally, all of which I thought was healthy. We had a guy here who felt moved to rise to the defense of the market and capitalist system, and I thought it was necessary. I'm glad he said it, so that you know I probably should have. You know, the market does, if it is organized if it is genuinely free, in my view, and it's not, you know, shot to hell by all kinds of subsidies for roads, and, you know, you don't have to pay for the pollution and everything, I think a genuinely free market really does serve both the individual and the community interest. You know, with some support systems for the free market is never going to serve everybody equally well, and so you need some support systems around the side. But I think that the market, a genuinely working market, really does serve both the individual and the community well, and that should be our goal, is to figure out the ways to construct that system. And we've been others have been successful at it, and I know that we can be as well.
Well, one of the problems is that you can make so much money taking, you know, undeveloped land and getting it rezoned, that that's a huge economic driver in terms of lobbyists and politicians. In fact, one councilman in Maryland many years ago almost got run out of town because he proposed the city should buy up these low zone areas, rezone them, sell the land, and use the profit to you know, pay for city expenses.
Yeah.
He was not popular with the developers.
Understand. All right, well, thank you all very much. I don't want to, I'm not kicking anybody out, but I want to give people who do want to leave the commission to leave. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The other story you can talk about.